Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR for Thursday. It's the 11th of April, 2013. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're along here today. Coming up, we have a lot of culture on the show today. We learn about the commingling of Latin American cultures and U.S. cultures from a guy who is highly qualified to talk about that. Jim Forger over at the MSU Department of Music. They've got some interesting things planned for this weekend. We hope you can stick around. Last Sunday's Lansing State Journal tore into the State Department of Treasury over its alleged inability to collect delinquent tax revenue. In a story by investigative reporter Stephen Reed headlined Tax Cracks, Reed wrote that since 2000, Treasury has had to write off more than $2 billion in delinquent taxes owed to the state. He and others in the story suggest that oversight and accountability regarding tax collection are weak. Terry Stanton is a spokesperson for the Michigan Department of Treasury, who joins Current State to respond to the article. Good to see you. Thanks
morning,
for coming
Mark.
In.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off with that number at the top of the page.
Mm-hmm.
Is it true that Michigan has written off $2.2 billion in tax revenue since 2000?
Correct, yes. And it's not so much about the numbers. It's about how the numbers are presented or how they're described. And you have to put them into perspective. $2.5 billion stretched over 13 fiscal years. Okay, we're not talking about $2 billion that was written off as of today. Boom, it's gone. We're not collecting it.
Okay.
We're talking about...
Since 2000.
Since 2000. Yeah. So 13 fiscal years. So you're looking at less than $200 million on average per fiscal year. Now, that being said, $200 million, still, that's a big number.
Still a mountain of
still
money.
Still a big number.
Yeah.
It is. But there are certain costs to doing business, and you can ask that of any business that does business. There's a certain write-off percentage. And any government that collects taxes is going to have to write off some business too. And there are reasons why, and we can get into that later. But when you look at that 13-year period, it's not $2 billion all at once. Not to mention, not only, that over that same period of time, the department received and processed $320 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So when you take $2 billion and $320 billion, you've got one-tenth of 1% perhaps that's been written off, the rest collected into the coffers. So
okay.
we believe that the department has a very robust collection effort, and we work to get taxpayers current and help them stay there.
This is an intensely data-driven story. Does the department dispute any of the other numbers in Stephen Reed's story?
Well, again, not that I can think of right offhand, but it's how you present those numbers and the perspective you put them in.
So your point is look at this thing from 5 miles up,
sure,
rather than just become too preoccupied with $2.2 billion.
Absolutely, because that's a big number, and it's true. But, again, when you take the long view, it's not as if at one point in time $2 billion fell off the earth because we just simply weren't going after
Understood.
It anymore.
Okay. The story, let's go a little deeper here. The story claims that sales tax, and I'll quote here, sales tax, quote, has the biggest collection deficit of any tax category, and that between 2008 and 2012, uncollected sales taxes after write-offs averaged some $700 million per year, and yet Treasury referred 12 or fewer accounts for prosecution each year from 2007 to 2011. In other words, it took legal action against that few cases, even with uncollected taxes totaling that much. Why haven't there been more referrals for prosecution?
Well, let me start with the $700 million figure, because that's a rolling figure. That, again, is not an annual figure. That's not $700 million in a given year. That's a rolling figure. So over time, we have 6+ years to work to do our collections, to use our various tools. So once an account, for lack of a better term, goes delinquent, we can pursue that account for up to 6 years. So if it hit the books in 2007, and we haven't collected it, it's still on the books in 2011. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So it's a rolling figure. It's not a point in time. There's $700 million, you know, that is going uncollected.
But do you typically spend a period of years trying to collect from delinquent accounts?
It certainly can be that way, yes.
Okay.
It can be that way. And secondly, as far as the referrals go, when you refer something to the Attorney General, that's a fraud, that's a criminal allegation. Oftentimes, and we disclose this to the reporter, you're not talking about something that was a crime or fraud. It was someone who fell behind. They weren't trying to perpetuate fraud, but you're working to collect that. So if the department believes that there was a criminal act or a criminal intent behind it, it certainly would refer the situation to the Attorney General. But that doesn't mean that we're only pursuing those 12 cases, because obviously there are many, many more that we are working to collect on.
But you're saying it has to rise to the level of criminal intent before you can even consider submitting it to the Attorney General?
Right. Absolutely, okay. Because they're gonna take that and try to pursue criminal charges, and if the case isn't there that it was a criminal case, then they're gonna hand it back to us and say, why in the world did you refer this to us? It's not a criminal situation.
Are there a greater? Do you fear that there are a greater number of criminal intent cases that you just would be unable to persuade the Attorney General?
I don't know that
rise
that's
to that level.
Yeah, I don't know that that's a fair speculation. I think those situations we become aware of and that we believe are fraudulent or criminal, then we refer over. But we certainly don't want to be referring cases that aren't or that couldn't, you know, hold the water.
You also refer to them in the article as difficult situations, mm-hmm. where the Treasury Department apparently feels a retailer or a business can play catch up on tax delinquency. A colleague of yours, Deputy Chief Treasurer Mary McDowell, was quoted in the article as saying, "Our objective is not to punish people. Our objective is to bring them into compliance," right. Unquote. So are Treasury personnel continually evaluating who might be brought into compliance and who might not? Is that just a part of your process?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I don't know that it's down to the macro level of, oh, this person only has X amount, but you have to determine over time, again, with our 6 or 7 or 8 years that it might take to pursue a back debt, at some point in time, there's a determination that it's not collectible. And some of the reasons are a death, a bankruptcy, someone has gone. They've left the state. They're no longer, we've got no, they've got no nexus to Michigan. We've got no way to get to that individual or that business. So they're, if someone's deceased, you can't get blood out of a stone. So there are particular reasons, or if they've gone bankrupt, there are particular reasons why a good portion of this is simply not collectible. It has nothing to do with the department making a determination that it doesn't want to go after this. That being said, Ms. McDowell is absolutely right. It's always our first inclination to work with taxpayers and to bring them current, to help them get current, and then keep them there going forward. We have the authority to seize properties. If it's a business taxpayer that has gone delinquent and not paid up, we can seize a property. We'd rather not do that. We don't want to have to take that action. We'd prefer to work with that taxpayer in the steps leading up to that potential seizure before, to make sure that it gets remedied. Taxpayers can also enter into installment agreements. If they, if they can't pay the lump sum, we can do an installment agreement.
You refer to a 6-year timeline that you have to pursue this thing. Could it be argued reasonably that 6-year timeline ought to be tightened?
Well,
how did we come up with that figure? That's
a question I can't answer. I don't know. I believe that's been the case for a number of years, and I don't know, you know, how it was arrived at. But I do know that there are various federal and state laws that govern these types of issues, not to mention case law and other situations. But I, you know, if you tighten that time frame, just trying to think out loud, you may reduce the amounts that you can actually recoup.
Okay, but you may increase it as well. It just may create more urgency
and I don't
in
know.
The situation. I'm just curious.
Right, no.
But
understand, if someone hasn't paid after 5.5 years or paid after 2.5 years, are they more liable to pay than they would otherwise be? I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Reed quotes State Rep. Fred Durhall as saying that Treasury originally resisted the idea of a tax amnesty a couple of years ago, claiming that the department didn't feel that there was that much uncollected revenue out there. The amnesty went ahead anyway, collected $81 million, some of it from sources the department apparently was not aware of. Can you go into this a little bit deeper? It appears Treasury misread this.
Yeah, I think that's an unfair criticism.
Why?
The proposal initially came out, it was at the tail end of the Granholm administration. And the administration at the time was not overly enthusiastic about conducting an amnesty. A program had been done in 2002, and there is some thought in the industry that if you do amnesties too frequently, all you do is convince people that, well, I won't pay. I'll wait for the next amnesty. There's going to be another one coming along.
Okay.
So if you do one every 6-7 years, you're kind of cutting yourself off at the knees, if you will. So there was a reluctance, I think, by the Granholm administration to say, yeah, let's go with this. And so some of the estimates on what would be taken in were fairly low. And there was a concern also that what you might do with that is pull money forward out of future years that you will collect, that you're in the process of collecting. Maybe you have installment agreements, but a taxpayer says, oh, well, wait a minute, I'll just, you know, jump into the amnesty, and so you're opening a hole, if you will, in future in out years. Now, that being said, once the legislation began being reviewed, going through the committee process, and really got honed down into what was going to be passed, our accountants drilled the estimate. If you go back and you look at some of the legislative analysis, they were right on target. Once they had the bill in front of them and looked at what they thought we'd take in, we were right. We were pretty much on the money. Now, what Mary did indicate was that a lot of the money, or a good portion of the money that we took in, was money we weren't aware of, which seems to bolster our position.
How?
That we are collecting what we are aware of, or we're working to collect what we're aware of. This wasn't, if the majority was money that we were aware of that was coming in that we weren't collecting, that would seem to make the counterpoint. But it was new money that we weren't aware of. Our collection efforts, we feel, are very robust and successful.
The article strongly suggests that tax collection is in serious need of greater transparency and oversight. You acknowledge to Mr. Reed for the article that under Michigan tax law, quote, the department's collection policies, procedures, and criteria are not public information, mm-hmm. unquote. Given the challenges in collecting revenue, can you explain to our listeners why more of that isn't public? Wouldn't
sure.
that enhance your ability to collect tax revenue?
It's in statute. It's in the Revenue Act.
I don't doubt that.
And it essentially, I can't quote it for you, won't quote it for you, but it essentially says exactly that. The Treasury staff, Treasury vendors, and the like cannot discuss or disclose tax information or confidential information that you have in the administration of a tax or collections, et cetera, et cetera. The reason being, if I tell you how we audit and how we work to collect, you have a better sense on how to avoid that. That's pretty commonsensical, right? There is a host of information that's available. The contract that we have with GC Services to assist with collections.
It's a collection agency.
It is. And it is posted online. It's open. The contract can be read by anybody. The state posts its CAFR every year to show the revenues that are taken in. I mean, there's an awful lot of transparency here. But what we can't do as a department is let everyone know how we work to collect, how we audit, because then it's much easier to avoid us when we come knocking at your door and saying, we believe there's a tax problem.
Okay. We are out of time, but I appreciate your coming in. Terry Stanton is a spokesperson for the Michigan Department of Treasury. Thanks, Terry.
You're welcome.
An artistic exploration of interwoven Latin American and U.S. cultures will be taking place on the MSU campus as part of the first Latin is America Festival coordinated through the MSU College of Music. Events will take place from April 15th to the 27th at various campus locations, and those include concerts and films, art exhibits, plays, and more. WKAR's Peter Wharf was joined by College of Music Dean James Forger and Professor Ricardo Lorenz yesterday to preview Latin is America.
We decided let's do a festival that showcases how Latin America is intertwined with the American culture, how Latin America is intertwined with the American culture, and therefore the title Latin is America. If you look at the guests, all of them make their living, or for the most part, make their living in the U.S., but their research activities in Latin America or around Latin American topics. And that makes it very interesting and unique.
Dean Forger, what are some of the key performers and performances that come together for this festival?
Well, this festival is encompassing traditional classical arts, jazz music, new music. So I would say steel band to jazz band to saxophone and piano to the MSU Symphony Orchestra to the Wind Symphony to scholarly presentations. And I think that the intent here, as Professor Lorenz was saying, is to make this an annual event because internationalism is exceptionally important. The Latin culture is important. It is embedded in this country. It is changing this country. It is part of this country. It's part of the future, and increasingly the future of this country. We hope to have a template that can be replicated each year with highlighting different artists, highlighting different repertoire, highlighting different connections, highlighting music, highlighting American music in contrast with Latin music. One of the pieces on my recital is by a French composer, Darius Milhaud, who went to Brazil during World War I. He was taken with samba, and so he wrote Scaramouche, which has the last movement is titled Brasileira, and it's a samba. The world is very small. This university proudly is an international university, and it's our hope to each year focus in different ways, celebrate different connections with Latin America, and celebrate that Latin America is part of America and it's changing America.
Dean Forger, you generously recorded a piece that you'll be performing on the festival with your spouse, Deborah Moriarty, the pianist, just last night, and then had that file emailed over to us. Tell us about that piece.
Well, one of the joys of seeing this festival unfold, and it's been led with magnificent leadership from Ricardo Lorenz, Mark Sullivan, Etienne Charles has played a compelling part. There's a connection with the overseas, the study abroad program that Ricardo is leading, and he met Maureen Reyes there, Cuban composer, who visited as a result of the study abroad, came here last spring, and we started talking about possibilities, and she said, "Wow, she found out that I played the saxophone, and you know, when you're a saxophonist, you embrace new music and composers." And it was just terrific. She offered to write a work for my spouse, Deborah Moriarty, and myself. And it arrived via the magic of email about 3 weeks ago. And it is a terrific work that is, on the one hand, challenging, and on the other hand, has a fabulous atmosphere, subtle rhythmic elements. It exploits the full range of the saxophone through altissimo. It uses some multiphonics, has beautiful melodies, and we're having a great time learning it.
Ricardo Lorenz, tell us what you hope that listeners will take away from this experience of hearing concerts on the festival.
One of the things that I'm hoping they take away from this festival is, first, very simple, for them to hear back-to-back these two cultures. One piece by an American composer, by one piece by a Cuban composer. And also there's other pieces. For example, there's a piece by Haydn being played in the last symphony concert. There's a piece by an Armenian composer.
On my recital, there's an Armenian, there's a Russian,
exactly.
There's an American. There are two Latin American works and one work influenced by, heavily influenced by Latin America. And there's a piano work, newly revised, that will be presented that is your composition, exactly. Ricardo.
So it is doing away with this idea of ghettoizing foreign cultures. Mm-hmm. Usually you have a festival all devoted to Irish music or Japanese music or Latin American music, and it's good because you get a fast glimpse of that culture. It ghettoizes, it territorializes, and this one is totally the opposite. So I'm hoping that the audience sees that Latin America is part of a huge global community, and that they just have the chance to hear this repertoire back to back and to see and meet scholars, filmmakers. We didn't mention that we're also bringing a filmmaker from Chicago, composers and performers, who, even though they are Americans, they have spent all their life researching the great, rich culture of Latin America.
Well, I really like that idea of making connections with one area or one style of music, but then across other styles, across time, across cultures, and hear the relationships.
Absolutely. I'm going to say something here that sounds like a tangent, but it's not. I go a lot to the Detroit Institute of the Arts. I love that place. And I think that they have been very clever in how they display the paintings. It used to be that you had, one room for the Impressionists, one room for Romanticism. And they don't do it anymore. What they do is, for example, they study portraits, and then they place next to each other portraits from Dutch painters, from German painters, from French painters, and from different eras. Right. So the audience gets to see how portraits have developed throughout 300 years.
Exactly.
Well, that's kind of an idea, the idea we have here. Instead of just presenting these pieces by these American composers, they are really decontextualizing. We're contextualizing them in our world here in Michigan, in the U.S.
Professor Ricardo Lorenz and Dean James Forger of the MSU College of Music, thanks for talking today about Latin is America going on at MSU through most of April. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
For Current State, this is Peter Ward. We'll be right back.
This Sunday, the Lansing Symphony Orchestra joins MSU's University Chorale for a performance of one of the first great mega works of classical music, Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610. The performance is in downtown Lansing at St. Mary's Cathedral. WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with David Rail of the MSU College of Music about the concert. He'll be conducting the orchestra and chorus on Sunday.
It's really a combination of old, really ancient techniques and the most what would have been modern techniques in 1610.
I did want to ask you about that, because just in listening to it, it almost sounded to me like the instrumental parts made me think of early Bach, and the vocal parts made me think of
so
way
it looks back to Palestrina, Josquin, even earlier Dufay, with this use of Cantus Firmus, a pre-existing chant, that all of the Psalms have this chant, sometimes in a voice, sometimes in an instrument, but it's ever present. Mm-hmm. But then there are these instrumental interludes, some of the, particularly in the Magnificat, there are instrumental pieces that sound like Baroque dance music, mm-hmm. typical Italian Baroque dance music, maybe even Vivaldi, or as you said, Bach, Handel.
Okay.
So it looks forward to the end of the Baroque, but it also looks back to the early Renaissance.
If we've gone to church, most of us haven't had like a Vespers habit the mm-hmm. way they did in
right.
the Middle Ages. And I almost get the impression that whole service is kind of meant to kind of take you to another place, because you can just kind of fall into it.
Well, exactly. And so a couple of things I think are important. First of all, it's almost exclusively non-participatory. We think of going to church and we have things that we do. We stand, we sit, and we say prayers and we sing hymns. For a Vesper service, one would essentially have been probably seated. There might have been a little bit of standing and kneeling. And one is mostly listening, seeing, probably smelling. Candles and incense are important parts of Vespers, because it's all about light. It's the end of the day. It's about light. So I think the experience of Vespers then and now involves a variety of senses that we might not always associate with, quote unquote, going to church today. The other thing that's important is that Vespers was historically, particularly in the Baroque, the late Renaissance and Baroque, and into the Classic period, the time where the most elaborate music was performed. Not so much at Mass, but at Vespers, particularly Saturday Vespers in some churches, or Sunday Vespers in other churches. But
why was that?
I don't know. It's an evening, so it may be doubled as quote-unquote concert time. I don't know. I know from my own research into Charpentier in France in the end of the 17th century, it's the most interesting music is focused on Vespers and Vesper Psalms and Magnificats. Same thing's true of the Italian Baroque, not so much on Mass settings.
Monteverdi is kind of a transitional figure between the Renaissance and the Baroque. And so talk a little bit about the aspects of that. What will people be hearing from both of those?
So I think one of the biggest differences is that with the Renaissance, we associate the Renaissance with purely vocal music, unaccompanied a cappella music, and it's probably best exemplified by somebody like Palestrina, the most important composer at the end of the Renaissance. And one of the things that happens in the new music of the Baroque, the new music that starts at the beginning of the 17th century, is the use of instrumental forces, particularly instrumental dance music. So you'll hear some instrumental, what sounds like instrumental dance music. And also this new vocal style, which is created for opera. Opera has its beginnings right about 1600, both in Florence and Mantua. Monteverdi is a part of that. And they create this new style of quote-unquote reciting, but they're singing. So it sounds a little bit to us like recitative. So there are some movements in the piece that are in that new monodic style, the new operatic style. And then there are some movements that will sound very much reminiscent of Palestrina, Victoria, De Lasso, people from the end of the Renaissance.
The Vespers seems to be one of the, if not the first kind of super work on the order of, you know, Bach's St. Matthew Passion or one of the oratorios of Handel.
Other than specific masses, for example, the Pope Marcellus Mass of Palestrina or various masses by
Dufay or Josquin. It really is the first quote-unquote major work or major choral orchestral work. And in fact, the interesting thing about it is that it's part of a collection that includes Vespers and actually a Mass in addition, which we're not performing and which doesn't get performed very often. But yes, I think it's fair to regard this as perhaps the first important quote-unquote choral orchestral work of Western music.
I was looking at some of the other things that happened in 1610, just because when something gets known for the Vespers of 1610, you say, well, what else happened in 1610? You know, Galileo's getting the moons of Jupiter, Hudson Bay's being discovered, the settlement at Jamestown is going downhill fast. And, you know, classical music, when we hear it enough, 300 years, 400 years doesn't seem like a lot to our ears, but when you put it in the historical perspective of what was actually happening at the time this was published, it seems like a really long time ago. How do you take a choir in 2013 and get them in touch with what they need to be in touch with to perform a piece like this?
That is an interesting question. This is a cliche, but there is something timeless about this music. I would tell you that this has been a much easier sell to my choir than a number of other pieces, some of which have been written more recently. There's a certain inherent drama to the music, to lots of the music that they love. They can kind of tear into it in a dramatic way. There's something very human about it. And I think because Monteverdi was essentially a dramatic composer, he loved to compose for the stage, whether that means writing madrigal cycles or actual operas or this sacred music. So there's a dramatic quality to this that I actually think is really appealing. My sense is that my students have warmed to it really, really quickly, surprisingly. I think selling them on Bach St. John Passion was a harder sell than the Monteverdi. Now, St. John has all those dramatic qualities as well, but the music's more challenging technically. And I just think there's something about this that is very, very accessible for singers. And I think it'll be very accessible for audiences. I think there's something visceral about much of the music. It's very colorful music. So there's wide ranges of vocal color and instrumental color. There's a big, a brass section and a string section, and they alternate and they combine in different ways. There are soloists, and there are sometimes two different choirs, SATB choirs, singing back and forth. So it's very colorful music. It never stays the same for very long, has lots of variety. So that seems to have been really easy for my students to embrace.
What part of it do you find most inspiring?
Well, it's like asking someone which of their children they like.
Right,
best.
Right.
I actually think the most, perhaps my favorite movement, if I had to pick one, is actually the Dixit Dominus, which is the first psalm, actually the second movement, but the first psalm setting, mostly because it has everything, all the different elements that are going to come later in the piece. A pair of soprano soloists and a pair of tenor soloists. It has something that we call falso bordone, which is choral chant, which has a certain dramatic appeal to it. It starts in kind of a gentle, mysterious way, so you think you're, when it begins, I always think that I'm maybe hearing some kind of Palestrina or Josquin motet, and suddenly it picks up lots of steam, and there's lots of drama and lots of contrast. So I would, if I had to pick one, I would pick that one, because for me it has everything that is to come is in that movement.
Dr. David Rail, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Tomorrow on Current State, we'll talk with leaders from Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America about this weekend's rally. Also, a preview of films and music from the Capital City Film Festival tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Sonia Treweiler for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.